Hello, and welcome to another episode of Easy Mitellini. My name is Toby. The Philippines is a country in Southeast Asia. It has a very dynamic history, from its colonization period to the Cold War to being to this day, like a lot of places in the world, exploited by dictators, whilst being simultaneously sucked dry by international corporations, in addition to being used as a pawn by Western powers in geopolitical games. From what I've heard from the people to whom I spoke in order to produce these episodes, and from what I've read during my preparation, actually it seems like the Cold War is still very much ongoing in the Philippines. And that's why the topic of today is the human rights struggle over there. Before I made these episodes, I knew next to nothing about the situation, and it has been quite the journey. There is a lot of ground to cover, and I would definitely encourage people to do additional reading when they are interested. To this effect, I will include some links in the description of this podcast. But first, we will start with a short and therefore extremely general overview of the recent history of the country. As mentioned before, the Republic of the Philippines has had a turbulent history. Long time under colonial rule, it finally became independent from Spain on June 12, 1898, but was subsequently under the governance of the United States until finally becoming a sovereign country on July 4, 1946. This, although the diplomatic and geopolitical influence of the United States is still strong to this day. In 1965, Ferdinand Marcos became president, and in the 70s used communism as an excuse to implement and maintain martial law and establish an actual dictatorship. In 1983, this regime was toppled by what is commonly referred to as the People Power Revolution. Then, in 2004, Rodrigo Duterte became president, who implemented an internationally notorious regime on an anti-drugs platform that led to an extreme rise in violence and silencing dissent of any kind. This could be through said anti-drug legislation or other methods, for example what is called red tagging, which publicly paints people as members or collaborators of the Communist Party and its armed resistance wing. This practice continues to this day. In addition, the amount of state-sanctioned extrajudicial killings became a notorious practice, leading to many deaths during his regime. Then, in 2022, Bongbong Marcos, the son of former dictator Ferdinand Marcos, became president, and Sara Duterte, Rodrigo Duterte's daughter, became vice president. And whilst Bongbong Marcos seemed to want to take a step back from the extreme measures of his predecessor, in practice, it turns out that there is not much difference. In order to get an impression of what is it like to live and work as an activist or journalist in the Philippines, I spoke to two people. Cristina Palabay, who is working with an outspokenly left-wing organization named Karapatan, and Rhea Padilla, who is a journalist and member of the Outer Media Network, a network of independent community media outlets in the Philippines. Both of the interviews went great, but the interview I did with Rhea was plagued by a tropical storm that interfered with the network to some extent. Both interviews started with the question, what is it like to work under the current circumstances? Where first we will hear Cristina, and then Rhea, and then Cristina again.
President Duterte, as you can see, remains free from any prosecution. Outside, of course, from the investigations being done by the International Criminal Court, he remains untouched, as well as the military and police generals who are said to be involved in the framing of policies, including the drug war policies and what we call the counter-insurgency policies.
comparing the current administration to the previous administration, which is the Duterte administration, the government is kind of notorious for threatening media and closing down the biggest network in the Philippines during its term. So compared to that time, it would seem that the human rights situation is getting better because the president, the new president, are giving less verbal threats. It's known to be mellow and posturing as democratic, but actually the human rights situation and the state of freedom of expression in the Philippines is still being attacked and silenced. I mean, the press is still being attacked and silenced. The difference could be that there are less verbal threats from the president now, but it doesn't mean that the landscape has actually changed. It actually may even be worse because there's an effort to make it appear that the government looks amiable, the government looks, you know, mellow, but there's no real action to address the human rights situation, the human rights violations across the country. In fact, the Reporters Without Borders released its latest report that says the Philippines landed on the list of deadliest countries for journalists. That's actually alarming because the others on the list are currently in the middle of a full-scale war, like Palestine, like Ukraine, and we even rank higher than countries like Syria, Sudan, and Somalia, that are also known to be in the middle of armed conflicts or civil war. So that says a lot about how dangerous the Philippines is, especially since we presume ourselves as a democracy. And the RSF also reported that the Philippines slipped two places on the World Press Freedom Index for 2024 and currently ranks, I think, 134 out of 180 countries. So a lot of media groups have, you know, been recording incidents of attacks and threats against media workers.
That's the thing about it, no? There's an armed conflict. There's an armed resistance since many decades ago, precisely because the roots of the armed conflict have not been resolved, whether there have been changes in precedents. No? I mean, we had what is called the People Power Uprising, the so-called peaceful revolution in 1986, no? But it didn't change anything except for the fact that martial law, formal declaration of martial law, is not there, no? But what we have right now can be considered what is called de facto martial law, no? Because the infrastructure is there, policy is there, the mindset remains the same, of especially of the military and police. And at the same time, the roots, meaning the inequalities that drive such violations, are still there. The second thing about the situation here is that all the, what we call the infrastructure of impunity, is there. Yeah. So that means the military, the soldiers, have this mindset that they are king, yeah, over, they're supreme over civilian authority, and therefore have the license when it comes to peace and order. Would also tell you that the justice system also plays a role in the civilian functionaries. Courts, prosecutors are also in the business of keeping people inside jail for baseless charges. And that includes charges under the what is called the anti-terrorism law.
There were several issues that came up almost immediately when I speak to somebody who knows a little bit about the situation in the country. Extrajudicial killings, red tagging, enforced disappearances, and imprisonment.
So whoever they brand as dissenter, as communists or terrorists, are easy targets for them.
Could you define extrajudicial killing?
Extrajudicial killings mean the deliberate execution of individuals, the murder of individuals done by state actors or their agents. So to a certain extent, it's a higher premium is put when this is done by state actors, because states essentially are duty bearers of rights. They are signatories to several international and domestic international conventions or treaties. They are the ones who make the laws. So it is expected that there's a higher standard of obligation and, of course, accountability, you know, when perpetrators of killings, of executions, are from the state machineries.
A practical example of such extrajudicial killings are two media workers that Rhea told me about.
Okay. Ray Blanco was stabbed to death while Crescencio Bundokin was shot to death while he was doing his broadcast. And Percy Lapi, the other one, was on his way to work to the radio station where he was going to have his program. And that really sent a message to media practitioners, because usually killings happen in the remote areas of the country, in provinces. But in the case of Percy Lapid, he was killed in the metropolitan area, in Las Piñas to be exact, which is very near where the major networks are, because it's found in the capital, in the city. And he was killed in broad daylight. And he was known to be a critic of the Duterte administration, the previous administration. And he was really against corruption. He was exposing a lot of corruption cases. And then I think the media community was shocked because the new administration was just entering, was just starting its term. And then suddenly there's a media practitioner who got killed in the city on his way to work.
So that continues to this day, Toby. And in fact, we've documented at least 99 killings in the past 2 years of the current Marcos administration. Several victims of enforced disappearances who remain missing to this date, victims of torture, illegal arrests and detention, and the fact that we have nearly 800 political prisoners in the Philippines.
Also very prominent in the Philippines is a practice called red tagging. This practice paints opponents of the government as communists.
It means that if you are red tagged, meaning if you are labeled or called, whether as an individual or as an organization, as a member, supporter, or a front of the Communist Party of the Philippines, the New People's Army, or the National Democratic Front of the Philippines. These are groups which are considered revolutionary or national liberation movements in nature. You will be easily targeted. In short, the targets are on your back when you are labeled as such. So, this phenomenon had its recent gained traction, not only in the past 5 years, but more so in the past decade after the 9/11 and the U.S. war on terror. Then human rights defenders are called enemies of the state, troublemakers, etc. But this time, being called a communist has a pejorative meaning to it. No?
Rhea gave me some more information on red tagging against journalists and media workers specifically.
Actually, one of our partners, the National Union of Journalists of the Philippines, documented almost 160 incidents of red tagging against journalists since 2016 when the Duterte administration came to office. And in just 2 years of the Marcos administration, of the Marcos Jr. administration, the NUG has reported already 63 incidents of red tagging. And the study found that 60% of the incidents of red tagging against journalists and media outfits were perpetrated by the state itself. And in some cases, state agents even visited the homes of red tag journalists and actually threatened them or talked to their families or talked to village officials to say that, oh, they are members of this group, or they're members of the media organization. And that organization is being red tagged or being labeled as a front organization of armed groups. So
in the past 2 years, we have documented more than 3 million victims. 3 million, could you imagine, Toby, of such form of red tagging. So those are the dangers, no, of red tagging. If it's, you know, if it's just being called a communist, it's not a crime, no? But what happens after, the consequences on your life and security is dire.
Yeah, so that's one of the things I really want to highlight, is not just the killings, but also the what we call the practice before actual attacks happen is the red tagging, and it's still continuing up to this up to the present.
I also have a question. We're nearing the end of the interview, or like my questions anyway. I had one clarifying question about the extrajudicial killings and the red taggings, because you said you mentioned mostly, like, let's say, state officials, police officers, but I can imagine in a country where there is such a culture, like you said, you said also fascist, and I think that's actually quite the right word. Would that then also mean that if you get red tagged, there is a lot of violence from non-state actors, like civilians, let's say, or just people in the society?
Well, you might say that too, no, Toby, because when state actors essentially endorse violence against you, they also, in a way, encourage public violence, no, against activists or individuals doing human rights work. So that usually happens also. Yeah. The rhetoric may be online, but we also feel it too in the course of our organizing work in communities. Some had endured some physical attacks because of it, by what we call, well, you might call non-state actors, but those induced, right? Violence is induced by the state. So it can also mean that some businesses are involved, meaning those who own companies, for example, for trade unionists, no? Because suppression of trade unions, for example, benefit big businesses, you know, or the employers. So those are what I might say sources, non-state actors who also commit human rights violations. At the same time, it also paints you in a corner and isolates activists. You know? This is an attempt to isolate activists, journalists, the troublemakers, so to speak, you know? From being listened to by the general population or the public. So it has short-term and long-term impacts, I would say.
This was part one of a two-part series on the struggle for human rights in the Philippines. It was edited, written, and produced by me, Toby, with significant contributions from Cheren Ushakal. You can find this podcast, among many others, on Spotify under VC Mitalini and also on cba.at if you do not have a Spotify account. Our email address is vcmitalini@riseup.net. For any recommendations or questions that you might have, do not hesitate to send an email. Thank you very much for listening.